It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. Okay, we got that out of the way. I think we've handled the problems of the world, right? Well, here's another problem of the world. Let's bring in Jim and Jamie Dutcher. Good morning to you two.
Good morning, Mike.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. If you go to my website, MikeNovak.net, and this week's show, you will see a lot of information about an exhibit that the Dutchers just opened at the Field Museum called Living with Wolves. It is in addition to a book they just put out called The Hidden Life of Wolves. This is something, you two, that I have been hoping to talk about for a long time, because I get these notices, and you know, all of us are inundated with emails and causes that we're supposed to respond to immediately, and usually with money. But I do get information from Defenders of Wildlife. And one of the things that I've noted from their emails that has just completely outraged me is the treatment of wolves in the west part of our country, in the American West, especially because they were protected under the Endangered Species Act until, as you point out in your book, April 14th, 2011. Allow me, as an introduction, to read. No, you know what? I'll tell you what. I'll have you guys tell me about that, because rather than me read the, tell me about what happened on April 14th, 2011, Jim or Jamie.
Well, the wolves were protected under the Endangered Species Act, and from a population of 66, it was brought up to about 1,700 wolves, where their protection was taken away from them because the number had increased, and that's fine. But it was the management of these wolves was turned over to the state governments. The bill was actually hidden in the as a rider in the budget bill. It was never discussed. And so the wolves lost their protection. We had about 1,700 wolves at that time in the three western states. We've killed way over 1,000 of them now. And the hunting season goes on and on. An individual in Idaho can hunt for 10 months and kill or trap 16 wolves. There's proposals to gas the pups in the dens in Wyoming, to use silencers on the guns in Montana, and even to use the carcasses of dead wolves or even the puppies of wolves to attract the family back into the traps, using the social ability of this animal, the attributes of this animal, to actually wipe them out. And this is not about putting a trophy on the wall. This is about getting rid of a species.
Well, this,
what's even more outrageous is that, you know, because this was snuck through as a rider in the budget bill, it was the first time in the history of the Endangered Species Act that a decision to take an animal off the list was done by politicians and not scientists, which now sets a precedent for any creature on the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, this is why I'm so outraged about this, because it continues to happen. You were online when we were talking about the Monsanto Protection Act, and it kind of went through in the same way. It's now we don't even have the guts to tell the American people what we're going to do. Our Congress people do not have the guts to tell the American people what they're going to do anymore, because they're afraid the American people will say no. So they just sneak things in, and then you wake up one morning and, oh my goodness, you can't sue Monsanto anymore. Oh my goodness, you know all those wolves that we finally got back into the wilds in the American West? We just killed most of them because the ranchers don't like having wolves there because they,
it's inconvenient.
It's inconvenient, right.
Yeah.
And as you point out in your book, and the genius of your book is that you don't start with this. You start with, here's what we did. We went out there and we lived in the wild with these wolves. We raised them. We actually created a pack. And then you talk about the social aspect of the wolves and how they're like family, and how in some regards they're not really that different from human beings. And then you go into and say, and now look what we've done to those social animals. in the time since we were out there raising them. I'll tell you what, let's talk a little bit about your experience back in the early 90s. How did you get the idea and I know it probably stemmed from your work, Jim, as a nature photographer, but you wanted to get close to wolves, I understand.
Right. Wolves are very afraid of people. And if you see a wolf in the wild, they see you way before you see them. They're impacted by your presence, and they change their natural behavior. We wanted to study the social behavior of wolves, how they got along as a family. And so we raised pups from the moment they opened their eyes and created a pack and camped with them for 6 years in the mountains of Idaho, where we made documentaries for television and wrote books about them. What we really saw was an animal that cared about each other. A mountain lion killed one of the pack members, and the pack mourned for about 6 weeks. They stopped playing. They stopped howling the way they normally did. Their behavior was impacted by the loss of this omega wolf that always instigated play. But there's also another story to the wolf. As bringing them back, we found that ecosystems have improved in Yellowstone, where they're studied. And the elk population in Yellowstone was way overpopulated with elk. And the Park Service was killing elk at night just to protect the resources. So having wolves back drove the elk up into higher ground to other places where they felt safe from the wolves. And now, because they're out of the riparian area along the rivers and streams where they felt safe because there weren't any wolves, the vegetation has come back. And it's sheltered the water and made the water cooler. There are more trout, and they're bigger trout, and there are more beavers, there are more songbirds along the creeks. The coyote population, which was way overpopulated, has been cut in half, and this has brought back rodents, which help birds of prey. So they really have a place in the ecosystem.
You know, I was talking last year on this program about coyotes in the Chicago area, and obviously there's a lot of urban coyotes, many more than we ever suspect. I have a feeling that people lump wolves and coyotes into the same category. How is it that they're different?
Well, they're very, very different animals. I mean, they're both canids, obviously, but wolves are more family animals, pack animals. You have a pack of wolves consists of mother, father, siblings, aunts, uncles. It's an extended family. Where coyotes generally live in much smaller groups of parents, and then you have the most current offspring, and then the offspring from the year before, which are starting to move on. Another big difference between wolves and coyotes, which made wolves so easy to eliminate in the early part of the 20th century, was the fact that since they are so socially bonded, if they know a pack member is in danger, they will go in and try to help that pack member, where coyotes will just flee the scene. You know, we've been using that social bond that they have with each other, that family bond, against them. So, you know, and wolves and coyotes also look different, but that's very hard to, it's very hard to see unless you really know wolves and you really know coyotes. Actually, we were in the Chicago area last week, and someone was saying, "Oh, I saw a wolf in downtown Chicago," and it's like, no, it wasn't a wolf. it was a coyote. So, wolves have more rounded ears. Coyotes are a little more pointed. Coyotes have a more pointed snout, where wolves have a little bit more rounded snout. And there's also a size difference, but it can be hard to tell unless you're used to seeing them a lot.
And you're pointing out part of the problem is our ignorance, of these animals, our ignorance of what they do. Part of what you do in the book is attempt to debunk a lot of the myths about wolves, such as that they're dangerous to people. You say over the past 100 years in North America, now listen to this, folks, the past 100 years in North America, there have been only two cases in which wild wolves reportedly killed a human being. And that's reportedly. And to put this statistic in contrast, also in North America, bears have killed at least 35 people since 2000. That's 13 years. And since 1990, cougars have killed 9. In the United States, domestic dogs kill approximately 30 people every year. And the wolves have killed maybe 2 in 100 years. That's just an amazing statistic.
Yeah.
Well, there's just an intolerance of having this animal back. There's all the myths of Little Red Riding Hood and Three Little Pigs, and now we have the new misinformation that's out there that wolves are supersized and they kill for sport. These things are all just made up. It's not true.
So what about that myth about that the ranchers have, that they're killing their cattle and sheep and they can't possibly stay in business because the wolves are wreaking havoc?
Well, it's interesting. Since the reintroduction of wolves, livestock predation has turned out to be far less than anyone ever could have predicted. It's less than 2% of all livestock predation are attributed to wolves. Coyotes, weather, birthing conditions, domestic dogs, and other predators kill more livestock than wolves do. And, in some cases, ranchers are compensated for the loss of their livestock. And it's interesting. Our nonprofit has a large advisory board of ranchers, hunters, and biologists, people in economic aspects, and we have, we work with ranchers who have specifically had problems with particular packs of wolves predating on their livestock, and rather than having them kill the wolves, we've gotten these ranchers just to change their habits, going back to methods that they used 100 years ago when ranchers were ranching with predators. And just by altering simple things, they have been able to stop the predation from wolves and other predators. Simple things, by just keeping cow-calf pairs together longer, or by knowing where the den sites are and keeping your livestock away from those den sites. And it's important to know that most of these occurrences are happening not on private land, but on public land, land that we all own. So, we need to figure out ways to get along with this animal that lives on our public land as well.
That's Jamie Dutcher. Jim is also on the line. They are the authors of a new book called The Hidden Life of Wolves. It's a beautiful book, wonderful photographs, and many of those photographs are at the Field Museum exhibit. Is that correct?
Yes, they are, yeah.
And that runs through July 7th of this year. And I've got the link to my website, mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show. I need to take a short break. We'll continue this conversation when we come back. I want to talk about... I got lots to talk about. I can just go and do a rant, but I don't want to do that. I'll let you guys do that. Excuse me. But I want to talk about your experience in living with wolves. See, before the show, we realized that I was raised with wolves, and Rob here in the studio says he dances with wolves. But you guys, you guys actually, and you hear those jokes a lot, don't you?
Yeah,
we do, but it's fine.
Oh, well, sorry about that. I got to come up with something original here that you haven't heard before. we'll talk about your experience there and about wolves in the Midwest, maybe a little bit. And I have to remind folks, if you're listening to the show and you have access to my website, on the homepage, MikeNovak.net, MikeNovak.net, there's a short video about the book Hidden Life of Wolves and Living with Wolves, and you get to see Jim and Jamie and their experiences with the cameras rolling and the wolves in their sawtooth wilderness camp where they lived for about 6 years. On the line, I have Jim and Jamie Dutcher, who have written a book called The Hidden Life of Wolves. Their exhibit, Living with Wolves, just opened at the Field Museum. It runs through July 7th, so I think you want to go by. If you go to my website, you're going to see just a few of the photos that they have from the book. Jim and Jamie, let's talk a little bit. And as a start, let me tell you something that Rob said here in the studio before the show today. I'm going to use you, Rob, as an example. He was looking at the book and he was looking at pictures of you guys being kissed by the wolves in the morning. And he said, I would never do that. I don't know. It looked pretty cute, and you can see some of that on the video that's on my website, mikenovak.net. What was that like, and why did that happen?
Well, wolves are very social animals, and we had this enclosure that we built on the edge of wilderness and then camped inside it, and we raised these wolves as puppies, and we built a bond of trust with them. Now, they'd come up to us, and they'd sniff us, and they even lick our faces for a moment or two as we did this, because this is how wolves greet each other. We see this all the time because we camped in amongst them, and we'd get up in the morning, and the pack would be laying around our camp. We had to put up a little chain link around our camp so they wouldn't steal our shoes and such, because they're very curious animals. But one wolf would get up and go over to the alpha, lick his face, and then go on his way, and they all did that every morning. So that's what they would do with us. It was just for a moment or two, but they weren't a danger to us at all. They were socialized to us by the fact that we raised them from the moment they opened their eyes.
But it's really important for the audience to know that in no way were these animals pets. You couldn't ask them to come. You couldn't get them to do anything. All behavior studies that have been done on wolves have to be done in captivity, and it's usually done in enclosures of 1 to 3 acres. And we had the largest enclosure in the world, 25 acres. And, you know, if you were fortunate enough to find a pack of wolves in the wild that you were able to habituate your cameras to, the next time you point something at them, it might not be a camera. It could be a gun. So, you know, this was a way to keep wolves in the wild safe. So, you know, we just let everything unfold and let the wolves just be wolves.
But don't you still inadvertently make them a little less sensitive to humans just by having been there and having interacted with them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one thing that they lost that they would need to survive in the wild was fear of humans. And that's really just, you know, the way it had to be done, and we knew it was going to have to be done that way. But we weren't, you know, trying to observe them, you know, hunting for, you know, traveling for hundreds of miles, or, you know, bringing down large game. And that, you know, unfortunately is the one trade-off. But, you know, we believe that everything we captured was really right on, according to other, you know, biologists and scientists. And, you know, a lot of people would come to our enclosure and go, wow, you know, I always thought that happened, but I can't believe I'm really seeing it. So, you know, it really gave us an intimate look into their social life.
When you started this pack, and I say that advisedly because you did bring in pups. Let's talk a little bit about where you got those pups. What was the gene pool like?
There was a woman up in Montana that acquired a pack of wolves from the Navy in Alaska. There was a pack up there that was habituated, and they were experimenting with tranquilizer drugs, and the project was over. The Navy was finished, and she acquired these wolves, and then she had seen a film that I had made on mountain lions and thought that we could do some good for wolves if she gave us puppies. So that's how we acquired the pups.
And then you raised those, and then you brought in more puppies. Was that from a different gene pool?
From different parents from that same pack up in Montana.
Yeah. Now, the reason I ask is because one of the things you mentioned in the book is that for isolated packs and confined packs like Isle Royal in northern Michigan, those wolves are beginning to show the damage of inbreeding, aren't they?
Right. Right. They, wolves crossed over to Isle Royale during a particularly cold winter when an ice bridge was formed. And that pack, you know, thrived on the island for quite a while. But because there have been no other wolves coming over to there, it just hasn't been cold enough. The population has been isolated, and they're finding, I think, bone deformities and other problems. And that's really what we could be looking at in the western United States. By isolating the wolves that we've reintroduced into these tiny islands, like in Yellowstone National Park and then in very few areas, and not allowing them to be able to find each other, you know, for dispersers to be able to start new packs, we're really creating a recipe for disaster. There's no way the gene pool can survive.
Well, how do we undo the damage that was done by taking... Now, obviously, they should still be on the endangered species list, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, especially because they're killing them all. Yeah, there's, you know, to get an idea, we have 550 wolves in Idaho. We have 50,000 coyotes, and we have 20,000 bears, and about 2,000 to 3,000 cougars. But we can't tolerate 550 wolves.
That's just insane. Yeah. You know, actually, I'm kind of surprised that ranchers know the difference between a wolf and a coyote.
They don't.
Okay. That being said, how is it then that coyotes can breed so well and wolves can't?
Well, as I mentioned before, you know, coyotes are much more survivalists, I guess you could say, than wolves are. And it's been so hard for people, you know, who've tried to reduce populations of coyotes because, you know, coyotes, if they see a bad situation going on, if a den is, if people have invaded a coyote den or, you know, the coyote parents will leave. They'll leave and they'll start somewhere else. Wolves are different. They will come in and they will defend the pups. They will do everything they can to protect them. And that's what makes them so easy to kill. Because they won't just run off. They won't leave their family members behind.
One of the techniques in killing a pack of wolves had been to take fish hooks and bait them and put them in a ring of cable and throw it down a den. And the pups would digest these hooks, and then you haul the pups up screaming and tie them to a tree and stand back, and, of course, the pack will come back to try to protect their offspring, and then you shoot the pack.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's not different today. Now we're going to use silencers because the bang of the rifle always scared the rest of the wolves away. Well, now we're going to use silencers.
All right, so we have... You know, your hill is incredibly steep, the hill that you have to climb.
Yeah,
not only do you have to undo the stupid legislation that got sneaked in because our legislators are cowards and craven, but you have to then try to change hearts and minds, which is to say you need to understand how wolves behave. And once you do, you will not treat them this way.
That's right, and that's what we do. We travel around the country giving presentations, but this book with the National Geographic spells out everything we've been trying to say with other scientists and ethical hunters and ranchers contributing to our work, and it's an educational tool. I think when people understand that wolves aren't these evil animals that are a danger to us and that they really have a place in the ecosystem, people change their attitudes, especially children. Children get it. They love these animals. They got recycling. They taught their parents to do it, and that's our hope. And our organization is called Living with Wolves.
You know, I was just going to say, kids understand that that gay people are human beings too and need rights. It's you know, the next generation gets a lot more than the generation before them.
they do. And, you know, it's really interesting, Mike. Jim and I speak all over the country. We do big multimedia presentations. And I can't tell you how many times where we've had, you know, people in the audience who are skeptical, which is great. We love that. And, you know, especially hunters. And we've had, I can't tell you how many hunters have come up to us after a presentation saying, oh, you know, they were dragged there by their kids or their wife or whatever. And I said, you know, I've always wanted to kill a wolf. And they said, I can't do it now. I didn't know they were family animals.
When our first film came out, a hunter from Minnesota wrote us a letter saying, I watched your film, I always hunt, and I hear wolves, and they scare me. But now I know differently. I watched when you moved the pack to the Nez Perce Reservation, and the alpha went back for his brother to coax him out of the crate that we moved him in. And this camaraderie that they have, this caring attitude, he said, I didn't realize it. He said, I'm getting two new hunting dogs, and I'm going to name them after members of your pack. Thank you for explaining this to me.
Let's take a couple of seconds and explain that, because I read the book and I know what you're talking about, but you keep throwing around alpha and omega. I don't think our the average listener here in Chicago understands what you're talking about. Describe what the alpha pack member is and the omega and how they interact or don't.
In a pack or a family of wolves, you have the leaders, and they're usually the alpha male and the alpha female. They're just more. They just have that leadership ability to them. It's sort of like on a playground as children. There's always one child that sort of takes that leadership, and then there's on the opposite side of the spectrum, you have a child who's very timid or shy. Well, that's the omega in the wolf pack. And in the middle, there are mid-ranking wolves. Only the alphas mate, and they mate once a year. Sometimes when conditions are poor and there aren't any prey to prey upon, they won't mate at all. If there are occasions where the alpha will let the beta wolf mate because there's so much prey. The beta wolf is the second in command. In our case, our wolf that was what we thought was the beta wolf, he befriended the omega, and the omega was always picked upon. He was forced to eat last, and they had this friendship, and they would travel around together, and if there were fights and the omega was being picked on, the beta wolf would interject himself, break up the fight, body check the other, and just, you know, change the subject.
Wow. You know, yeah. In Chicago, we have our own alpha. That's Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah.
But that's a different story.
Yeah. Without that family.
who knows?
Does he body check?
Yeah. I don't know. I think he does.
Politicians could learn a lot by watching wolves.
You know, they could, and not just about being alpha, but being beta, about being omega, about getting along.
Caring for each other.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just amazing, and that's what I got out of this, is that these creatures are worthy of our respect and worthy of our admiration. And this, as you point out, and anybody knows this, and you've mentioned this already, we have this instinctive, almost instinctive fear because of the ignorance that has spread over millennia, basically.
Right. Right. And, you know, we talk about this in the book. You know, early man developed a relationship with wolves, and they probably watched wolves to hone their own hunting and family skills. And the most social of the wolves and the most social, early humans got together and you know, we eventually created the dog. The dog was our first, very, very first domesticated animal. So the wolf actually enabled us to turn it into the dog, and then allowed us to domesticate other livestock, and really evolved with us. We altered each other's evolution, and everything seemed to be going great. We all worked together until humans became more pastoral. started raising their own livestock and started looking at wolves as competition rather than partners. And that's where things started to go awry.
And then they really went south in the United States in the 19th century, where we wiped out the bison, we exterminated the passenger pigeon, mm-hmm. We tried to exterminate the wolf.
And Native Americans.
And good point.
Yeah, it was manifest destiny.
Yeah.
You know.
And basically white guys with guns.
Yeah. Conquer the land and make it pure for agriculture and farming.
So, Mike, this hunting season that we have here in the West, now that we have wolves back, because before reintroduction we were down to maybe 15 to 50 wolves in these three Western states, but now we brought that population of reintroduced wolves from 66 to about 1,700, and as I pointed out, we've killed about 1,000 of them. But killing wolves is sort of it just doesn't work because it makes the situation worse. And let me explain. If you had a pack of 12 wolves and you hunted them, you would probably be able to kill 4 of them, and the rest of them wouldn't hang out as a pack. They would be so traumatized that they would split up in twos and threes. They wouldn't be able to bring down their natural prey because they don't have the manpower anymore. And so these young adolescent dysfunctional youngsters would go after livestock instead of their natural prey. So it's really making everything worse.
I want to bring up one thing before I let you go. And by the way, that's Jim and Jamie Dutcher. They are the authors of The Hidden Life of Wolves, published by National Geographic. Thank you for bringing up that before. Let's give them kudos for that. There's a foreword by Robert Redford. One of my listeners says that more than 150 wolves were killed in Wisconsin last season alone, most by trapping. What about wolves in the Midwest? Are you familiar with that situation?
We are familiar, not, of course, as familiar as our situation out here in the West, but it's really a shame what's going on in the Great Lakes area. You know, you all have had a population of wolves that really was doing quite well, and after wolves were taken off the endangered species list in the West, the Midwest filed suit as well to have their wolves taken off. And you know, as far as I know, predation on livestock is incredibly tiny in your area, pretty much non-existent, and you still have a huge overpopulation of deer. And wolves, you know, the wolves you all have not been able to make a dent in the deer population. So now to be hunting your wolves, and you know, you really are, you're not doing a service to the overpopulation of deer, and then you're not doing a service to livestock producers in the area, because you, as Jim said, you could be creating problems that weren't there before.
It is sad. So what's the next step? How do we get them back on the endangered species list?
Well, the United States Humane Society is pushing to stop the trapping in Michigan, which is a start there, and it's a lot of lobbying. It's a lot of since management is now in the hands of the states, it is really up to all of us to just be incredibly loud and vocal, because what people have to remember is that wolves were brought back with all of our tax dollars. Wolves belong to all Americans, and for the most part, wolves live on federal land. No matter what state they're in, they're pretty much on federal land, and the states don't want you to realize that. So we all have a stake in this. We all have a voice, and you know, contacting your senators, your congressmen, and also Department of Interior officials, and really be vocal, because the people that don't want wolves are a very loud minority. Most people do want wolves, but they just haven't been loud enough.
And I have to say that, you know, even if it's going back to states, I don't expect enlightened policy out of the state of Michigan.
Oh, no.
I don't expect it out of the state of Wisconsin. And so my feeling is I think we got to go back to the feds. And
we've got to get wolves back on the endangered species.
Yeah. Jim and Jamie Dutcher, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much. Again, the name of the book is The Hidden Lives, Life of Wolves. And you can go to see their exhibit at the Field Museum that is called Living with Wolves. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. I'm going to put this on the podcast so we'll have a dedicated podcast of this conversation. And I hope we get to talk again real soon.
Great. And Mike, if people need to find their own representatives, they can go to our website, livingwithwolves.org, and we've got a whole section on how you can write a letter and who to contact.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. You guys have a great Sunday now.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.